Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is August 31st, 2004. Today's session number is BED 2004-01. Today's speaker is David Bella. The lesson for today is Understanding Complex Human Behaviors Beyond Blame. Chaos and Complexity, New Discoveries, Do They Matter? Let's listen in.
Okay, I'm Dave Bella, and I'm here to talk about complexity, chaos, nonlinearity, and all of this stuff comes out of mathematics in the last, or most of it, comes out of mathematics in the last, in computer simulation, in the last several decades. And the question is, why would we want to be concerned about that? Okay, because I'm assuming that most people are not experts in mathematics, and I don't even consider myself to be. Well, how about if you think it's important to understand Luther? Let's start out with Luther, Martin Luther. And I think most people would say, certainly in Holden Village, oh yeah, it's important to understand about Luther. Well, let's look at the history, okay? Luther, let's say, what, 1500. I'll just take roughly 1500, Luther. Before him, one lifetime, let's say, is Gutenberg, right? The development of the printing press. And so Luther's Reformation was largely based upon, okay, the fact that there was printing. Right? And that after Luther, there was this huge expansion, and we became a literate society. A European society became literate. Okay? That's the first thing. After Luther, I'm ahead, came Galileo and then Newton. Okay? Now, it's 100 years after. They didn't know each other. They weren't alive at the same time. In fact, Galileo, I think, died the same year Newton was born. But what we find there is a transformation into the modern way of thinking, our way of thinking. So you see, Luther really comes from another age. He's in the transition point, but he's still thinking in sort of a medieval kind of way, pre-modern way. And we're thinking in a different way. And to understand Luther, or to understand the world, maybe what we have to do is learn to think in a new way. Not to go back to what Luther was at, but maybe to realize how much our way of thinking has been shaped in the time since Luther, and since Newton in particular. Now, why mathematics? Well, come on, Andy. Why mathematics? Okay? Mathematics intimidates most people, including myself. So I think we're probably all, in that boat. But what mathematics does is a very formal, rigorous way of describing how to think through something. It's symbolic logic. So, in a sense, the applied mathematics represents a rigorous expression of how we think. Okay? Even though most of us don't think mathematics, they're the ones, the mathematicians, that take what is considered logic and they formalize it. Okay? Got it? Come on in. Okay? So, any question? Now, let me describe very briefly to you, okay, and I'm going to have to act it out, the kind of mathematics that Newton developed and that science applies. It's called differential equations. Anybody has differential equations?
Yeah.
Okay, you've had differential equations. Good. I always like to have people in here who know something more about the topic than I do. So that's how you learn. All right, let's use your imagination. Those of you who haven't, and those of you who have, we will have to translate what's going on in differential equations without getting all bogged down in all those equations, right? most of which we forgot. Okay. So let's suppose that I'm going down the highway. And it's going, let's see, that way would be south, let's say. And I'm going to go 20 miles an hour south. Okay? Straight road. And I start here, X. And I go for 1 hour. Where will I end up?
20
miles down. Okay, you got it? Now, it's all very rational. Okay? What it means is if you know where you start and you know the rate at which you're changing, you can make a prediction where you're going to end up. Got it? Yeah? Very simple. That's the essence of differential equations, applied differential equations. It means that if you know what's known as the initial condition right here, and you know the rate of change, you can make a prediction. Except the rate of change is not simply 30 miles an hour. That would be a very simple differential equation. Dx dt equals a constant. Those are the kind I like. Okay, bring it on in. But what happens is, in differential equations, you can describe the rate so that you really can be moving in space. And what the differential equation does is a formal way of describing, in a precise, exact way, formal way, the rate of change of something. And the idea is, if you know the rate of change, and you know where you start, you should know, be able to make a prediction of where you're going to end up. You got that? That makes sense? And let's just think in three dimensions. We could have it going not just north and south, but east and west and up and down, and we could have differential equations say, we're going to start right here. Okay, three dimensions. And it's going to move, we'll just calculate after a particular time, and bing, we end up right here. That makes sense? And what we have is, of course, the science of prediction and control. And what really is important is to get precise measurements of where you start out and be able to solve the equations to make precise predictions. That's the expectation. Okay? Now, here's the interesting thing that happened. For 300 years, okay, we did this. And there were two categories of equations. Linear and nonlinear. And it turns out that they knew how to solve the linear equations, but they couldn't figure out how to solve the nonlinear equations. Now, when you are confronted with an equation that you can't solve, okay, no matter how simple it is, what is your tendency to do? What do you do with it?
Shelve it.
Shelve it, correct. Put it away. And that's what science and mathematics did for 300 years. They took the nonlinear differential equations and, oh man, a few weird guys, you know, studied this. Now they're no longer weird, they're geniuses. Okay, that's how, you know, science works. Okay? And what happened is they just ignored them. Now, you might say, oh, there's no problem with that because, you know, after all, they're all the same thing. And, you know, linear is just a simpler version of nonlinear, so one day we'll get to those. Turns out, that's not the case. That's not the case. Along comes the modern computer, digital computer. And what you can do is, even though you can't solve these equations, there are approaches called numerical methods, finite differences, where you can approximate the solution to them very closely. And that's what they did. Okay, now we can do nonlinear. And the results they got were bizarre. Bizarre. Weird. The nonlinear world is different than the linear assumptions we make about it. For example, one of the things you have is, if I measure this to 10 significant figures, nobody does that. And I got the world's biggest computer to go ahead and make the prediction. And after a given period of time, I predict, bam, we'll end up here. Okay? I did my homework. Now we get somebody else in the room, they forgot the assignment. Okay? And so what they do is they just guess at the initial position. They just guess at it. Okay? After a period of time, you won't be able to tell who's guessed and who got the accurate one. If you did 9 significant figures and I did 10, and you guessed, after a period of time, you couldn't tell the difference between ours. Okay? Sometimes, ours would be closer. Sometimes, yours and mine. And sometimes they'd be in 3 different places. In other words, the idea of precise prediction, simply because I take precise measurements, you can't do it. And you can't do it, not because, well, gee, if we only had more information. This problem occurs even if you use the whole universe to define your initial condition. Eventually, you'd end up with this, what's known as chaos. That is, it's deterministic, follows all the rules, but you still can't make prediction, precise prediction. Now, isn't that weird? That is weird. Now, I asked a colleague of mine, he's Octave Levenspiel. Octave, he was the 8th son of a Greek family, so they were Octave. So, and a brilliant guy. And I said, is the world linear or non-linear? And he leans back and he says, the world consists of bananas and non-bananas. The bananas are the linear systems. In other words, the world is non-linear. So the whole idea that we, if we're precise, when we make all our measurements, we're going to be able to make a precise prediction in non-linear systems, it doesn't work. Now, if you take just a short period of time, you can get away with it. It's just like if you've got a curve, you only take a small portion of the curve, a straight line is a pretty good approximation. But once you go out for a longer period of time, it's just you know, if I'm here at the edge of this platform, you know, a straight line works fairly good until you come to the edge. And in the nonlinear world, there are edges. The whole system can flip into a whole other pattern. Whole system flip. And you can't predict where it is. Now, it turns out that let's examine a little bit of some of these properties of nonlinear. You've got to understand them. But understand does not mean be able to make precise predictions. One of the interesting things that happened in this mathematics is a given set of equations would start swirling around in 3-dimensional space, the results. And you'd see these patterns and you could say, oh, those are the Lorentz equations. And mathematicians would actually go, and scientists would go to a scientific meeting and they put on the results and on the board, all these colors swirling around, and people go, ooh, ah, you think they're watching a fireworks display. And that person would sit down, and the next presentation would come up, and you're going, what does this mean? What does this mean? Bizarre stuff. And they called these patterns, recognized patterns, attractors. Strange attractors. That's a term that's used in mathematics, strange attractor. And I could draw some of them up on the board, and if some of you had worked on them, you could recognize them just from my sketch. And yet you still can't make a precise prediction. So the lesson seems to be, if you really want to understand nonlinear systems, maybe you ought to just look for patterns. And you're never going to make precise predictions. Now here's the other interesting thing about the nonlinear world. In the nonlinear world, you can't add up the parts to get the whole. In differential equations that you had, the linear equations, that was known as superposition. Okay, the rest of you, forget it. You don't have to worry about it. Okay, it means that you can't add up the parts to get the whole. And you can't even tell the character of the whole in terms of the character of the parts. The character of the whole may be very different than the character of the parts. And we go, oh, wait a minute. My bank account? How much do I have? I add it all up. Well, yeah, that's a linear system. But a nonlinear system, let's think if the world were linear, I could be a great musician. You bring in the piano here, and I say, how do you like this note? Boom. How do you like this one? Now I'll play a black one. Isn't that cool? Yeah. Now I'll play great music, which is simply the sum of great notes. And I start playing, and you'd say, stop, that's terrible. Okay? And what I would show you is that the whole is not equal to the sum of the parts. Okay? If the whole were equal to the sum of the parts, if you could take the whole and break it down to the parts, then what you could do is you could analyze, that's the word for breaking things down, is analysis. Analyze a joke in the following way. We'll just break the joke down to its basic components, which are words. We'll measure the humor content of each word, and then we'll add up the humor contents, and we'll see if the joke is funny. It won't work. You know people who get all the words right, and it's still not funny. And some people mess up the words, and you're dying laughing. There's something about the whole. Now, this is a radical challenge to the way we think. You break things down into parts. That's good in a linear world, and it works for linear approximations. But in a nonlinear world, you can't do this. Take the university. The first thing it does is it divides up into disciplines and departments, breaks them down into little pieces, and the pieces do not interact. On paper, there's interdisciplinary. In reality, there isn't, or very little. Yes?
Is there a simpler example of a nonlinear system that doesn't, that parts don't
add up? Simpler than music? Well, a joke? Probably not, because you see, part of the nature of linearity, nonlinearity, is complexity itself. Complexity itself is not simply complicated, it has interactions. That's what makes something complex. It has interactions. And so if we try to break it down to something simple, that is a straight line, it's no longer complex. And what you do is you remove the properties of complexity itself. You see what I mean? So the simplest example I can give is the joke and the music. Now, you're onto something, and I'll get back to you later. Well, then how do we understand complex systems? We have to take some simplification of them, right? And you're right. But there's two ways you can simplify, because we have to simplify. We can't treat the whole world just, oh, it's just one big complex, and we go crazy. Okay? One way to simplify is to break it down into parts. You can't do that in the nonlinear world without losing things. The other one is to try to understand patterns as a whole and not worry about getting precise predictions and precise measurements. And that's the one I'm going to follow. Okay, so you think of all the ways that we analyze things. University, break things down into parts. Mathematics, solve the linear equations. Okay. Specialization. Our language, we have a line of reasoning. A line. That's another definition of linear, arranged in a line. And you can break things into pieces. Okay? A chain of reasoning. And we know that a chain is only as strong as its weakest link. Okay? So therefore, you do that link, you do that link, you do that link, and if we all do our work well, it'll all link and form a solid chain. That's a linear way of understanding. Okay? Because in complex systems, they're not lines. Which comes back to Gutenberg. When we became a literate society, we began to think in lines. The average book is a half a mile long. Okay? In a complex patterns, there is no beginning and no end. They loop around. Okay? But when you write about them, you write about them in a line. And when you write about them in a line, you start thinking in a line. The line of reasoning, the chain of reasoning, and we begin to miss things. We missed the holes. In the biblical text, what we've done, probably as part of analysis, is we actually have chapters and verses, so we can break them down. When did they begin that? So Somebody know? Anybody have an idea when they started actually listing chapters and verses?
I think 1700.
Okay, so at the same time Newton, this is about Newton's time. Before that, they didn't do that. They told stories, and we know that an oral culture thinks more holistically. A literate culture thinks more literally. So fundamentalism, literalism, is a modern expression. It has happened, what, in the last 150 years, something like that? It doesn't go all the way back to Adam. It doesn't even go back to Luther. Okay? To be a literate, take literal interpretations, you have to have a literate society who thinks in lines, who breaks things down, quotes this Bible verse, boom! Like this. This one, boom. It's like me playing music one note at a time. In a non-linear world, you cannot do this. Now, there's some other interesting things that have happened during this time period. There's a guy, Wilfred Cantwell Smith, and Smith is a historian of religion. Brilliant guy. Brilliant guy. He translates meaning. Doesn't just translate language. I only speak English, but I'm very good at translating meanings across disciplines. So when I read Smith, he's brilliant. And what he does is he plots the titles of books. And so right around 1600, 1700, something like that, you know, okay, on one side Gutenberg, on the other side is Newton. Okay, there's a transition zone. And before that transition zone, the word religion didn't even come up. The word, it's not in the Old Testament. In the New Testament, I think it's sometimes even negatively, as a system of beliefs. What was crucial was the word faith. And then, right about this transition time, the word religion started being used in the titles, and the word faith started disappearing. And then, once we completed the transition, then it was religions, in the plural sense, such as Buddhism, you know, Protestantism and so forth. Categories, breaking them into parts, categories. Now, what Smith claims is that in that transition, we lost the meaning of the word faith. And we lost it by defining faith equals belief, particularly belief in propositions. He calls that a modern heresy. A modern heresy. And he says, one of the most important things we have to do in our world, this is before terrorism, this is before this came out, is we have to rediscover for the modern world a deeper meaning of the word faith. It cannot simply be belief, particularly belief in propositions. And he even goes back in the English language that the word we call belief actually came closer to the word beloved. And he quotes one place where a minister, and he says, we would translate it, believe in God but not in the devil. Well, a fundamentalist would say, I believe in God and I believe in the devil. And maybe an atheist would say, I don't believe in either. Well, the person who said that in that translation would have thought of both of them as crazy. Because beloved means, who do you give your heart to? So how can you give your heart to God and to the devil? You see, the word belief was really beloved. What do you give your heart to? So can you give your heart to God and the devil? No. You'd be schizophrenic. Okay? And a person who didn't give their heart to anything, what were they? Nihilistic, I guess. These, you know, anything goes, or I don't know. So you begin to see the meanings of words. Now, one of the things that happens in nonlinear systems, they go along real nice and then flip into a whole other system. This flip. Okay? Now, I think they are, and yet, sometimes these nonlinear systems, when you're trying to change them, no matter what you do, you can't change it. Okay? Other times, they call this a bifurcation point. This little, the flip of a butterfly's wing, they say, can flip the system to a whole other system state. That's one of the properties of nonlinear systems. I think the ancients knew this, and they told it in stories. Let's take Sodom and Gomorrah as an example. Abraham comes, and God says, I'm going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. And Abraham negotiates with God to lower the standards. Right? Lowers the standards, lowers the standards, lowers. Finally, he can't go any lower. He's going in increments of 10. It's really funny. Okay? And God says, yeah, okay, I'll lower the standards. And Abraham himself cannot save Sodom and Gomorrah. No matter what he does, he can't save Sodom and Gomorrah. And Sodom and Gomorrah destroys. That indicates a system. Okay, no matter what you do to it, it's locked into a certain behavior. It's very hard to get out of them. Okay, now let's contrast that with the story of Jonah. Jonah, is my interpretation of it is, and I learned this from Cece. She was dying of cancer. She told the story, and I never laughed so much. It's so funny. Jonah is totally incompetent. He's going to run away from God. Okay, this is a big joke. Okay, he gets out in the ocean, gets thrown overboard, gets barfed up on the shore by a fish. He's smelling like dead fish. Finally says, okay, I'll go to Nineveh. Goes to Nineveh, this huge city. He gives one of the worst possible sermons, like repent or get burned. Turns around, goes out, and he's up on a hillside waiting for him to get burned. And what happens?
They all repent.
Okay, they all repent. Abraham couldn't do it. The little teeny Sodom and Gomorrah. He does it. This is the nonlinear behavior. And they actually developed a nonlinear ethic. And my interpretation of this nonlinear ethic is that there's a time when a system can flip. There's a time. Kairos time, let's call it. And it can flip into another pattern. And if it's not Kairos time, no matter what you do, nothing seems to make much difference. But then if it's Kairos time and you speak for justice, the whole system may flip and become just. The trick is you never know when it's Kairos time. Now it's a fantastic ethic. Just think of this. Let's suppose you and you call for justice and nothing happens. And then I call for justice. The whole system flips. I don't deserve any more credit than you do. Because I didn't produce Kairos time. But the real disaster happens when Kairos time comes and no one speaks for justice. You get it? And that kind of, that's fantastic. That's a nonlinear way of thinking. It's a nonlinear way of thinking. Okay? So what I maintain is that what we need to do is we need to think more nonlinearly. And that is a radical change in the way we think. Okay, it's a radical change. And I want to give you some examples. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to sort of pick up on what John gave yesterday. Okay, I'm going to pick up on that. But before I do, I'm going to stop. I get on a roll, so you got to stop. I want to see if there's some questions or comments that you want to add. Yeah?
You were saying earlier that fundamentalism seems to be really new.
That's what I'm told by historians of religion. Yeah.
It's interesting that the Pharisees might have done some of the same things.
Yeah, I think following rules has always been a case, but the idea of thinking in chains and thinking that this is a modern phenomenon. If you go back. Right around 1570, they basically had a transition in universities and how they taught. And they have some of the artwork describing how they thought before that. And there are these complex patterns of interactions. Then after the transition, they look like chains, branch chains, like this, the kind we see in modern books. So I think the idea of breaking the scriptures down into pieces, getting a line of reasoning, getting a precise set of rules, and you're essentially making a prediction. If I'm here and I follow all of this, I will end up here. Okay, that's linear thinking, and it represents, I think, the analytical way of seeing the world.
I was thinking how weather probably is a good example of nonlinear system that over short terms. Prediction is pretty good for a few days or a week, but long term it's worthless. But there are patterns. El Nino is
correct.
A big pattern
very good.
That
very
is
good.
Is evident.
Yeah, very good, exactly. And so we've got to learn to think more non-linearly to deal with those patterns. If you think a simple cause and effect, it just doesn't work. Now, I will add that even in mechanics that are used to design bridges, let's say, Newtonian mechanics, even there, there's really two bodies of knowledge. And I taught engineering mechanics. There's really two bodies of knowledge. We have the scientific, analytical, and then if you look at the calculations, you see, oh, there's a number here, here's a number. So you have safety factors, coefficients of safety, rules of thumb. Where do they come from?
Experience.
Experience, confession and repentance. the really dangerous thing, even in mechanics, but certainly in climatology and certainly in ecosystems, Barry could tell you some examples, is when you construct these formal mathematical models, which was my field, when you start believing that that's the way the world really is, you get in trouble. If you're using the model as a guide to help you make better decisions, all right, but you better recognize your ignorance. And there's a lot of examples. Yeah. Weather, good one. Yeah. Some others. Okay, what I want to do is I want to introduce very briefly a different way of thinking non-linearly. And I may, John and I have been talking about, I may follow up on his session tonight. I may go back to this because there's some staff who weren't able to come today, but you're welcome to come again. And what I want to do is I want to try and give you a metaphor or analogy that helps you to think about things in a different and non-linear way. Okay? And we're going to start out, and imagine I have a table here, painted white, and a video camera up there. Okay, got it? White surface, and I have a little edge on it, because I'm going to throw these coins on the table, and then I'm going to shake the table. And then we're going to view the video camera of what happens to the coins as they move on the table. That makes sense? Everybody got that? Now let's suppose I start out all the coins, and I push it down here in a cluster. Okay? So you look at the video, and the screen is up here, looking down, and you see a cluster of coins. Now I start shaking the table. What happens to the coins? Well, I got a little edge to prevent them from falling off the table. Okay, it's scattered.
Well, it depends on how you shake it.
Like this.
I mean, they could scatter, but they could kind of just sort of all move in the same direction.
It spread out evenly.
Try it with your coffee. Okay? You stir the cream in the coffee, okay? What happens? It spreads out. Now try to unstir it. Just reverse the direction. It doesn't work. So what you would see is, you may be one step ahead of me, though. Okay. What you would see is it would spread out. Everybody would sort of look at that. Okay, well, let's know that. Big deal. And you're getting bored. You're getting sick of watching these little coins bounce out and spread out. And as you sort of doze off and look up, I sneak over to the table, and one corner of the table, when you're not looking, I push down, and I form a basin. Got it? Now, you can't see that from the video. Now, the coins are all scattered all over the table. And I start shaking the table again, here it goes again, And what happens to the coins? We'll assume the basin is down here. What happens to the coins? They start gravitating down to the basin, right? Okay, that we'll call the basin of attraction, the attractor. Okay, now let's suppose that you observe this. Oh man, this is really weird. And so the way you're going to do this is you're going to do a close study of the coins. You're going to examine the coins, okay? And you're going to, there's so many of these little brown ones with Lincoln on it, and there's so many. You get statistical properties. You really become the taxonomy, okay, of coins, okay? Okay, I'm teasing it because this is a part of biology I'm not very good at. Okay, it's important in some areas. Is this going to help you explain what's going on?
No.
Not going to help you at all. Okay, this is sort of analysis. When we break things down into little parts, and we can think of human behaviors as in an analogous way, and if you simply pick up and say, oh, all right, now what is the nature of this person? It must be their values and beliefs, okay? That explains why they're going down into the corner. No. Under this analogy, you can't explain it that way. Now, you might say, well, wait a minute, this sounds a little abstract. But one of the things we can do is we can actually treat this, we can treat these, this tabletop as a map of behavior space. Okay? So we want to talk about it. And what we'll do is we'll pick up on what John had, and I drawn the map. And here's the map. And I did this before I heard John's talk. This describes our behavior. Each one of our behaviors is signified by a coin, a position. So this is what we call a map of behavior space. So if I'm a person who's not buying stuff and I'm not stressed out, I'm up in this part of the behavior space. You got it? If I'm a person who's buying stuff and not stressed out, I'm way up there. So you can describe anybody's behavior, just like the coins, by a position on the tabletop on our map. Okay? Now, what we're taught by the media is that if you buy stuff, well, that's going to be great. You won't be stressed out because you'll have all this stuff. What happens, though, what you've described, is there's a basin of attraction down here that sucks people in. And we cannot understand the basin of attraction by saying, well, what are their values? What is this person's belief? Any more than we can describe the shift of positions of the coins by looking at the coins. We have to learn how to look for basins of attraction. And a basin of attraction is a nonlinear entity. It's nonlinear. Okay, you get that? And what happens is we can be caught up and drawn in to a basin of attraction. Okay? And what I want to cover later in the week is how to describe the character of these basins in human affairs. How to describe them. And I will not use mathematics, because if you do that, that becomes another specialized body of knowledge, okay? And we have these people do the mathematics over here. When nonlinear says, you can't don't specialize. You see the problem? Okay? So we've got to get something that people can really understand. Now, I think the basins of attraction, okay, can help us really understand some theological concepts of really, really important ones. For example, I think we know that when people get caught up in a basin of attraction like this, it's easy to get in and hard to get out. And I've had my students, and later, probably this afternoon, I'll put it up. It's what the students came up with. They call that, the way they get into it, is the credit card loop, the credit card pattern. They get into a pattern of buying stuff, credit, and they get in debt. And it's so easy to get in and so hard to get out. Right? And then they're trapped. Is that a general lesson for society? That there are patterns that are so easy to get into, but it's really hard to get out. Okay? Yes. In fact, the way I want to understand those patterns is I'm going to use as a discipline to understand the context a portion from the Lord's Prayer. Lead us not into temptation. Temptation is pattern, the attractive. And deliver us from evil. Yeah.
How does this differ, David, from what people would, the kind of traditional thing
graph that people would use for this I'm stressed out and I buy stuff, which I think would be a graph that says, as we buy stuff up to a certain point, we can be less stressed out because sheer poverty is not exactly, is pretty stressful.
Right.
But then past a certain point, there's a point of enough at which, after that point, you become increasingly stressed out and increasingly trapped.
Okay. Right. And I think you got a good point. And you're talking about it, first of all, a different kind of graph. Mm-hmm. You're talking about a graph. This is how much stuff I got, and this is how good I feel. And the idea is it kind of goes up. Okay? Now, let me see if... But then something crashes.
Yeah.
Right, correct. The crash would be the nonlinear. See, in a linear system, you would just project on and on and on. More is better. That's the understanding of productivity. Productivity is a linear assumption that more is always better. And in a linear world, you say, well, it's better down here, so I can just extrapolate. Okay? So when you're linear thinking, you can use the argument, well, of course more is better. If you were really poor and starving, wouldn't more food be better? And the answer is yes. Let me draw a similar one that may be familiar to your experience as a student. I can have on this graph down here, stop me if I'm departing from your question. Down here, this is the amount of assignments that I give in tests. And this is how much the students learn. I can say, well, you know, if I don't give them any assignments, they don't learn anything, right? It's kind of like, okay. So if I give more assignments, they learn more. Now, the standard notion of productivity says, well, give more and more, and it just goes up and up and up. And what happens is, some people have this straight line, some people say the law of diminishing returns. This is what they'll say, which is still a linear assumption. The slope is always up, more is always better. What do students tell me? They say, yeah, it goes up, and then past some point it crashes. And I'm not learning anything except how to pass the test. And that's very similar to consumption. Yes, more and more stuff, I'm getting better and better. You reach a certain point where crash, the very act of consuming, in a sense, occupies so much time and effort that you just don't have the time to enjoy what you have. It's more complex than that. The same thing with the students. They'll tell me, look, when it crashes, I've got a choice. I can either pass the course or learn the material. I can't do both. Yeah.
From the medical perspective, I find myself thinking addiction. It's easy to get in.
Okay.
Alcohol, whatever it is. But hard to get out. And you could project, well, if you feel good with one, then you're going to feel better with more. But then the person crashes.
Right. And I think you're right. I think addiction is part of it. I would go that the addiction is not simply what's chemically going on in your head, but what's going on in your patterns of relationships. And I would say the same thing for what you wrote. You had to say that becomes, you get in a pattern of relationships that reinforce the addiction. Okay? And you got to get out of that pattern of relationships. The real challenge for me, and this is what I'm going to be doing over the next couple of days that I'm here, is to describe a way, doesn't use any mathematics, that draws upon the experiences of people who are caught in these systems. We have to be confessional and we have to listen. Okay? And if we are confessional, we admit that we ourselves get caught in these things and we have to say why. And if we're good listeners, we have to be able to listen to people to understand the nature of the pattern, which is very different than blaming them. So blame is a linear concept, I think. We take the whole of what's going on, the part, these bad people. Okay? It's a linear assumption. That what we need to do is lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Where the us includes ourselves. And the people who are in there, even if we're not caught in the credit card loop, we've got to be able to understand that pattern in a way that if we were caught in it, we'd probably do the same thing. Okay? Which is very different than blame. Now, this has some real, I think, challenges for us. For example, on the subject of evil. Evil. Okay? In the non-linear world, we talk about the emergence of something. It's an emergent outcome, which means you cannot break it down to the qualities of the parts. Okay. When we usually talk about evil, we break it down to the parts. Evil outcomes happen because those guys are evil. We blame the parts. And we cite the prayer, thank God we're not like them. Okay? If the world is nonlinear, and I believe it is, then evil may be a property of the whole, and when we look down to the behaviors of people in the evil patterns, we see people like ourselves. Ordinary people caught up in a pattern that has become destructive, and I would say demonic. That's a term that I want to reintroduce. So you can see how I want to understand the notion of evil by trying to see how people, these coins can be drawn into here, and one of those coins may have my name on it. And when we're down in here, we can have some really destructive patterns. Now I'll give you just a little preview, because some people are leaving before we get there. That what I intend to do later in the week is I want to pick an outcome everybody would agree is evil. So we don't have to argue whether, well, was the Iraq war really, you know, all this stuff. And it's the Soviet biological warfare system, mass producing smallpox and anthrax on huge scales. Okay? And I want to understand how people got caught into this. And I will base it upon a book written by Ken Alabek. His name used to be Alabekov. He was the chief researcher. And it is a remarkable confessional book. And when I read that book, I'm giving you a preview, it's going to tell a lot about myself. And I can read that book with two prayers. One of two prayers. Thank God I'm not like him. Where have we heard that prayer before? A Pharisee who went to the temple to pray. Right? The second prayer is lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil, where the us includes myself and Alabek. Now, in order to do this, okay, rather than me telling you that this can be done, I want to do it myself. Because in the study of Alabek, I discovered a lot about myself. Alabek was involved in research, considered to be highly competent, and we tend to think of those as good things. I've been involved in research, and I've been considered competent. I thought of those as good things. But here's the concept that we're going to uncover. Is competence good or bad? No, that's not. When does competence become demonic? Okay, now think of it. Now, the notion of demonic is a fantastic concept. The demonic is always associated with the good. Okay? And the demonic involves a means to doing good, a vehicle to goodness, such as being competent, cure diseases. But it becomes demonic when the means to being to goodness, God, becomes overextended and it becomes a substitute for goodness itself. That's the demonic. Think of church history. So you have a doctrine in the church. It's a means to doing good. And then people end up killing each other, okay, in the name of the doctrine. and in the name of the Prince of Peace, it becomes demonic. Okay? It becomes the good instead of a means to the goodness. And what I've discovered through reading Alibaba is competency can become demonic. So that's what I'll cover. Okay, questions?
Would you spell his name?
Alibek?
Yeah.
A-L-I-B-E-C-K. I've got some handouts here.
Okay.
And I've written this stuff up. I am working on a project called Faith, Competence, and Evil. And the idea of faith is that when you're caught in these, it fits very closely with what Peter, if you went to Peter's session, remember the session he told about the young woman who went to pray out in the woods? Remember that? And the mother says, well, God's the same everywhere. And the young woman says, yes, but I'm not. What we say is, who we are depends on whether we're in the woods or whether we're at other places. Okay? And what I describe is the context describes who you are. God transcends the context. God is beyond the context. And when we simply act in context, that's all we ever do, we're separated from God. That's called sin. So faith, then, is that kind of responsibility that transcends the context, goes beyond the context. Okay. That's where I'm heading in terms of my understanding of faith. Yes?
A person in my church would respond to that idea of the trough of attraction, whatever you call that, as that just being a fancy way of saying you made a bad choice.
Well, the problem is you say you made a bad choice, it's kind of like picking up the coin and saying, ah, you made a bad choice. Put it down there. And, you know, what does that, you know, what does that mean?
It's a mask. What he would say, it's a mask. It's a, you, because being human is about making choices, which he would say, is that's a linear thing that the person does. It's either you do this or you don't.
Yeah, and what I would say is I don't think that's a good way to describe human behavior. I think to a large extent, how we behave, the choices we make, are shaped by the context. Okay? For example, if I go to the university library, they are not yelling and cheering in the library. At the football game, they are. Okay? What's the difference? The context. Now, if I were to pay you a couple $1,000 to go yell and cheer in the library, you could physically do it. But as you approached the library, what would happen to you?
You would feel stupid.
Your stomach would turn. And you hadn't read it. It's not because you're breaking the rules, because you hadn't even read the rules of the library. We are context-sensitive beings. That's what makes us humans.
His response would be, but there's a price that anyone will do anything like that, and that's making a choice.
And what I would say is, if we simply say it's a choice, individual choice, we're neglecting the power of the context. And we're neglecting the power that is necessary, but we're also in the danger of neglecting and trivializing the power of evil. The power of evil. And do we have a couple minutes? Don't we? Anybody read the Stanley Milgram test? Want to turn that light off? Heard about the Stanley Milgram test?
Yeah.
Okay, some of you have heard about this. This is a very powerful, done in the 60s. And what he does is he brings two people in to do a test on education. And you draw straws, and the person who gets the short straw is strapped into a chair with electrodes. And the person who draws the other straws is the teacher. And what they're doing is, the teacher has this series of switches that have electrical shocks, and they start from a mild shock to high voltage, danger, so forth and so on. And the assignment they give to the teacher is ask the question. Every time the person gets the wrong answer, you flip the switch, and they get a shock. And each time they get a wrong answer, they get a stronger shock. Okay? And they describe this experiment, and really, the person in the chair is an actor. The person doing flipping switches is the only one who's not in on it. And they create a context of running the experiment. They have a person with a white lab coat out there taking the data, and there's nobody, they're not being paid that much to do this. And they ask psychologists, and they script, and the person in the chair has a standard script. Like when it gets up into the middle shock, stop, I want to get out, this is painful, screams, yells. Goes a little higher, I'm a heart condition, let me out of here, screams in agony. And the last switch is totally silent. And they ask psychologists, leading psychologists, and anybody that I could find that was considered an expert, what percentage of the people would go all the way? And they said something, oh, 0.1%. The majority of the people went all the way. They were us. Statistically, they were people ranged from, you know, a whole wide range of people, majority of people. And it wasn't that they were comfortable going all the way. And what the experts had missed was the power of the context. To act out of context is extremely difficult to do. And sometimes it's an act of faith to do that. So the experiment really kind of shows how powerful the context is. And in this case, it was a context of the authority for scientists. What I'm studying is how the scientists themselves get caught up in the context. Okay. That's even more powerful. Okay, even more powerful. So the context is extremely powerful. I think if we simply say, oh, it's a matter of choice of your values, that's kind of like looking at each individual coin and say, well, that one did it because it's a penny.
Well, this guy's taught physics in high school, so what does he know about human nature?
Well, yeah, but remember, the people that they asked what percentage, these were the experts on psychology and sociology, and they got it all. They were wrong. And I think what happens is we're too reductionist. I think most of academia looks at coins. And they don't realize how powerful the basins of attraction are, the contexts are, these patterns of behavior, how we can get drawn into them. And I think that evil expresses itself like a basin of attraction. I'm not saying that's the only way evil expresses itself, but I think it does. And if we're simply looking at bad people, good people, we will miss that. Because I think we will find, if you study history, evil involve ordinary people getting caught up. And I think we should confess that. And then I think we have to realize that we have a responsibility to God who transcends the context, whatever it might be.
I'm just thinking of, you know, my own childhood growing up, and many of these basins are recognized traps that people like your parents and pastors and the scriptures warn you against, and Proverbs, and so isn't, you know, if you have a relationship with God and you have the concept of obedience, I'm thinking, as you know, being a coin, is that not somewhat protective to you if you manage to resist the context because you know you've been told about the context?
Well, I would watch out. I think our Christian tradition would tell us to watch out, because then when we say, oh yeah, our tradition allows us to do this, and we've been raised this way, and then I go ahead and I look at these guys in the Soviet biological weapons system. And if I think that way, I'm going to sound a little too much like the Pharisee. Okay? And I think that parable of the Pharisee should always be there, because you know and I know that we can sound like the Pharisee, and there's a lot of Christian Pharisees quoting scriptures saying
that. Yeah, and I'm just thinking that the parable of the Pharisee is there.
That's right.
So we are given a road by which we can see this coming. Doesn't mean we'll be able to
not
behave that way.
I'm not sure we're given a road. I think we're given a warning that confession should be taken seriously. We can't ourselves get caught in confession. And arrogance is very dangerous. And so I would say the Lord's Prayer, lead us not into temptation, is because we do get caught in temptations. And I think if we simply say it's a matter of values, and we've got the right values, we got a danger.
Well, I'm not saying that we're there, but I'm just saying that we do have access to something.
I would say we have access to these traditions, and they have tremendously powerful aids to us in living life. They really are, and I would treasure them. I would say, however, that if we simply approach them in a linear way, we can trivialize them.
I agree with you.
And one of the trivializations on evil is it's good guys and bad guys. And as soon as we start falling into that pattern, I think our tradition comes back and warns us. I think that sort of warns us, wait a minute, you sound like the Pharisee. You got it all together. Well, wait a minute, now what? Now, one of the things that when you do try to get out of the context, you can get lost. I mean, and this is where I think discernment was so important, and the spiritual direction, the session we had there, that if you think that there's easy answers, when you get out of the context, our tradition tells us that's going out into the wilderness. You get lost out of the wilderness. You can get totally lost because the context tells you what to do. And yet that's where God speaks to people. So it does warn us, tradition. Very.
Just something that comes to mind as a concern is people who look at this and use it as an excuse that I'm not personally accountable, I'm caught up in the context.
Right.
I'm just one of those points, like everyone else, you know, right. I'm sliding towards that base of attraction. It's not my fault.
Right. And that's been a criticism. And what I would say is we've defined responsibility too narrowly. If all we define as responsibility is within the context, we are missing an essential dimension of responsibility. And I name that faith. That's where I use faith. That we always have a responsibility that trans to God. And like in Peter's story, God is the same everywhere. That is, God is not shaped by the context. There is a God that's out there. But everything we do is shaped by the context. So we always have a responsibility that transcends the context. And so by saying that, what I'm able to reintroduce is the notion of transcendence. It's not this woo-woo thing of, you know, there's this thing out there called God that's, you know, way up in the sky. It's more like we do live in these patterns of behavior, but there are responsibilities. And when we pray, when we think of our traditions, they tell us that. And those responsibilities transcend whatever patterns, whatever context we're in. And we can study history and show that where people simply accepted that notion, narrow notion of responsibility, disastrous things can happen. Evil happens. And that's the nature of sin, is where the context separates you from the transcendent God. That's the definition of sin, is what? Separation from God? Okay. But, of course, God doesn't hand us nice sets of rules. The world is, chaotic. It's just so far the rules work in a nonlinear world. We've got to constantly repent and learn as we go. Yeah.
Well, isn't it part of the tradition that we kind of battle not only personal sin, but also what I think Paul uses the term of principalities and powers, which is this
correct
bigger thing that controls us without knowing it often, and we can't necessarily always operate right in that context.
Now, Walter Wink is a theologian who wrote on this several years ago, and he uses the word powers and principalities as a system. And he actually takes some of the biblical expressions of the word world, like be in the world but not of the world. And he says there really were two translations. One of them is the natural world, which is treated in a wonderful way. The other one is the system, which is always in need of redemption. So be in the system, but not of the system. Okay? That's how he would translate that. Now, when I describe basins of attraction, I call them systems also. They are systems. In the complex world, we deal with systems. If you break them apart, they lose their character. It's like music. So I think powers and principalities, you're right. And I would say it's to a large extent the nonlinear helps us to understand the nature of powers and principalities. You yourself described really powerful systems, and then you said, and I agree with you, I'm suspicious of conspiracy theories or something like that. That it's a grand conspiracy. See, if there's a grand conspiracy, you can blame somebody for it. But suppose this is a self-organizing kind of thing. And that the people at the top are more trapped in the system than anybody. Okay? Then it's then how do you describe it? And then we'll say, well, then nobody's responsible. That would be what Barry said. Say, no, no, no. We're all responsibility, but responsibility transcends those powers and principalities. And just think of the phrase, King of Kings, Lord of Lords. And we say it, we don't mean it. That was a political statement. In a world where your loyalty was to the king or to the lord who was over you, to say, no, no, there's a lord of lords, that was a radical statement to make. That was saying there is a responsibility that I have that goes beyond the system of power that's there. Lord of lords, okay? King of kings. So it wasn't just kind of a nice phrase. It is a powerful statement. So power is crucial, and what I would say is power in the nonlinear world comes from these self-organizing, these emergent systems that are out there that are very difficult to grasp. But we know this from biblical stories. The devil is the personification of evil. Is the devil stupid? Would the devil only act to fit the categories that make it easy for us to understand it? No. The devil's always portrayed as clever and devious and appearing in tempting ways that draw us in. So,
And I think your system's understanding, too, is that the non-linear is that there isn't just one answer. I mean, that you can't just say, well, these people should do it personally, but on the other hand, you can't just say, we change the system and everybody changes. We have to be working at
multiple
a number of levels because those things are interacting with each other.
And I do think people who are caregivers and they work with someone, say, it's an abusive relationship. And by the way, the method I use, which I haven't really shown you, students actually will sketch patterns of abusive relationships. Through their own experience, or drugs, or they'll sketch patterns of credit cards. One even guy who gets a no girlfriend pattern. It's a pattern of behavior is in where I couldn't get a girlfriend. And I'll show you how some of them work later. And but those of you who've worked with caregivers, you know that when someone comes up and says, well, just get out of it. It's so simple. Just do it. I mean, that's really a very discouraging thing to tell someone. If these patterns really are powerful, talk about what a discouraging thing to say. I mean, it makes them feel like they're the problem, which is part of the pattern, you know? They are very powerful.
How would your people respond to that, Eric?
With God, anything's possible.
With what?
I said, with God, anything is possible, so those patterns can be broken. I mean, that's how people would respond to those who say you can not be homosexual. That's a sin, that because people do change, and that it can happen through prayer. You know, that's what people say.
Yeah.
That's the response.
Yeah. But I think of but how does God respond? How does God? That's a joke. Flood, story of the flood in the summer. Minister is out there and floods comes up to his knees. I have faith, I believe, God will save me. And his boat comes by. come on, we'll take you out. No, I have faith. God's going to save me. Pretty soon it's coming up to his chest. Boat comes by again. Come on, get in. Phones goes, no, I have faith. God will protect. I have faith. Pretty soon he's up standing on his toes and it's up here. And boat comes by. Let us get you out. Brother. No, I have faith. I have faith. Water goes up and he drowns. He ends up in heaven and the angel Gabriel's there. And he goes up to angel Gabriel. What happened, he goes, is I had faith and I still drowned. And then Gabriel sends a response to him in a Jewish accent. He says, well, we sent the boat by 3 times. and so, God does work, but he works through us. And remember one of the temptations of the devil? You can throw yourself off here and don't worry, God will take care of you, right? That was the temptation of the devil. All I have to say, I don't have to worry about this. God will protect me. Okay? So don't tempt God. Okay? Don't put God to the test. Okay? That was one of the temptations of the devil. The other two things, you went over the one temptation of turning the stone to bread, and the other temptation, of course, is wealth and power. Right? I mean, these are pretty relevant to our age.